Please silence all electronic devices.
Members, the nurse of the day today is...
The job we have as legislators is to decide where the lines are.
It is a very sacred and holy institution.
I'll move to amend the bill. Even the old folks
in Devon knew. He said, hey, ain't you Jesse Harris? And I couldn't deny that. I said, yeah.
I'm Elizabeth Dole, and I approve this message.
While I do not believe I did anything illegal or ever thought I was doing anything illegal...
You're fired.
North Carolina General Assembly enacted.
Any further discussion or debate?
Welcome to the inaugural WUNC Politics Podcast, a free-form roundtable conversation devoted to the political happenings inside the hallways of the General Assembly and around the state. I'm Dave DeWitt, Managing Editor for News here at WUNC, and I'm here with Jeff Tiberi, Capitol Bureau Chief.
Hey there.
Jorge Valencia, Capitol Reporter.
Hello.
And Jess Clark Fletcher, Fellow for Education Policy Reporting.
Hello.
And if you're listening to this podcast devoted to North Carolina politics, you probably don't need to be told what HB2 is. Business leaders, judges, entertainers, almost everyone else are expressing their strong feelings either supporting or opposing the law. And as we're recording this, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals has just dealt a major blow to HB2. And put billions of dollars in federal money at risk for the state. This is a story that changes all the time. But let's start there. Jeff, Republican leadership in the General Assembly has said repeatedly there is no appetite to make any changes when the short session begins on Monday. But this Fourth Circuit decision has to change something, doesn't it?
It will be interesting to see how lawmakers respond to the ruling yesterday, the three-judge panel out of Virginia. One school of thought is that this is going to kick back to the federal court. Lawmakers can wait and see how this plays out, and it could play out with several different scenarios. They could adjust. They could adjust HB 2. They could tweak part of this bill. Of course, you know, I guess gauging the pulse of the critics and the national uproar about HB2, it has to do with the bathroom provision. Of course, HB2 is much broader. It deals with local versus state powers. But to me, if they were going to, you know, quell any of the widespread criticism, it would have to deal with the bathroom provision. And there's no indication that they're going to do that. The money is a factor, as you mentioned. Essentially, what we have at this point, based on the ruling yesterday, is a juxtaposition. There's a breakdown between the federal stance of high school students who are biologically one sex and identify as another, have bathroom access. And what HB2 says is that they do not. So this, you know, it's a fundamental break. I mean, these are two different things. So what happens with this? Is there some sort of compromise? And I'm not exactly sure how that would play out. Does the state push this? And to your point on the funding piece of it, Title IX, which is, you know, 40 some odd years old now, is a law that came about in the 1970s in an effort to give equality to men and women, boys and girls, when it comes to funding and education. I mean, generally speaking. So if this violates Title IX, and yesterday's ruling speaks to Title IX, it says that denying Gavin Grimm, this high school junior in Gloucester County, Virginia, access to the bathroom of the gender with which he identifies, it is a Title IX violation. And if North Carolina is violating Title IX, or Tennessee, or Washington, or whatever state, it throws into jeopardy funding. Funding for programs for, children who are living in homelessness and adult
roads,
literacy programs.
Federal research funding for universities.
A wide range. And specific to the educational piece of it, it's about $4.5 billion. So to your question, we'll get a better sense of things, I suppose, when lawmakers convene on Monday. But at this point, there is no indication that they're going to substantially or significantly change House Bill 2.
Right, because it's also a political issue. And what's interesting, if you live in a bubble of one of the urban centers, Charlotte, Winston-Salem, Greensboro, here in the Triangle, you hear a lot of opposition. But there is support. Jorge, you covered a rally a week ago or so. There was a lot of supporters there. What did they say? And how entrenched is the support for HB2?
It's entrenched. And I thought that this rally was really interesting for a lot of reasons. I mean,
all of the public reaction to HB2, I think, has been very interesting. And this rally in particular, I think one of the things that set it aside from a lot of the public demonstrations that we've seen in North Carolina in the last few years, is that usually people come out because they are mad about something that state lawmakers did. They are opposed to something that they're planning to do or something that they just put into place. This was hundreds of people on the lawn of the old state capitol building saying, literally chanting, House Speaker Tim Moore, Governor Pat McCrory, State Senator Buck Newton, thank you, over and over again. And that's certainly out of the ordinary when people come out for large public demonstrations. And I talked to as many people as I could. There was a wide range of people there. I mean, for the most part, I think that people were usually in their 40s or older, probably had something to do with the fact that it was at 1 p.m. in the middle of the week. Mm-hmm. And to your question, the most common response that I got was that was a religious opposition to it, that they felt that you know, it was in line with their religious beliefs, that you know, one woman said, I just don't believe in transgender people, and that was really the core of the sentiment. People didn't really speak very much to some of the other provisions in this bill. Law, I should say, sorry.
It's a law now, yeah, obviously. And you know, the people who are affected by this, we see all kinds of people affected by this. People who had Bruce Springsteen tickets, not unlike myself. people who, you know, businesses, conventions, hotel owners. I mean, it's a broad spectrum of people who are now being impacted by this law. But the folks who are really, really impacted are students. Jess, you did a story about the 1.5 million students, public school students in this state. And because this is mostly, or a good portion of this law is about public restrooms and who has access and who doesn't, to which ones. It was interesting to hear from some of these high school students who are directly affected, or, you know, maybe indirectly affected. Let's play a little bit of that feature now.
Bathroom. The law allows Schaefer to use a gender-neutral restroom, but she says there aren't enough of them.
I've considered starting to use the men's restroom, but I don't know how comfortable I am looking and feeling the way I do. Like, that's not where I belong.
The art student says using the men's room would put her in situations multiple times a day where she may have to explain she is transgender. Schaefer says she's proud of. During the special session lawmakers held to pass HB2, Greenville Christian Academy student Chloe Jefferson spoke out against a Charlotte ordinance that would have allowed people to use restrooms that aligned with their gender identities.
Changing in front of my girl peers is already intimidating enough. Now we add the possibility of males changing and showering alongside me. This is something that makes me, and I'm sure other girls, even more self-conscious. Girls like me should never be forced to undress or shower in the presence of boys.
So that's interesting. You hear a little bit of a range of different opinions, but you talk to folks who are specifically affected every day by this. And what did you hear from them? And what do you feel like they feel about their future moving forward in the public school system?
I talked to students that were specifically against the law. I went to Broughton High School in Raleigh, and they have a really strong movement of student groups who are progressive and opposed to this kind of legislation. I think it's also important to mention that these students know transgender people within their own student body, either who go to Broughton or like Hunter Schaefer went to Broughton and then went on somewhere else. I think from talking to them, what I understood is that they think that if people got to know transgender people and could kind of understand that these are real people that are actually impacted every day by this law, they would have different opinions. At the same time, I think, you know, Jorge talked about the urban-rural split in terms of how people are perceiving this law and the support for this law. And I think that, you know, generally we think young people are more against this law than older people. But I think that rural split split is still there. I mean, you heard Chloe Jefferson, who's from Greenville Christian Academy, and then you have the religious angle there too. And I think that also extends to young people as well. There are young people who are against this provision. So I think that's important to mention. But,
so let me jump in. And, yeah. and newsflash here, there are people who are transgender living in many communities, if not every community across
right,
the state.
That's true.
This is an issue that high school students, that a lot of high schools are going to deal with. So trying to connect this story and the sentiment, at least in some high schools here, with this case in Virginia from earlier in the week, what happened with this high school junior, two things, effectively. One, Gavin Grimm can now move forward with his discrimination lawsuit against Gloucester County Schools in Virginia. Two, part of the genesis of this was that Gavin Grimm, who was born a female and identifies as a male, I believe I'm not flipping those, but he wanted to have access to the bathroom that aligns with his identity. He sought a preliminary injunction, which is something that a judge can grant and essentially says, yes, you can do that, or no, that can't happen for the time being. I mean, it's a temporary ruling until the legal proceedings move forward.
Right.
Well, the judge in Virginia said, no preliminary injunction, not even dealing with this, basically. And the appellate court in Richmond said that the judge didn't handle that properly, didn't use the proper legal etiquette, the proper legal steps in order to deal with the preliminary injunction. And essentially, the three-judge court in Richmond ruled that the preliminary injunction had held water. There was ground to seek that. So I think what at this point is inevitable, and I've reached out to a couple of legal people, and it's the reaction is not necessarily mixed, but we're waiting. We'll wait and see. It's kind of a wait and see approach. I think it's inevitable that a preliminary injunction is going to be sought here in North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that might be a 16 or 17-year-old student in Raleigh or Hendersonville or New Hanover County or wherever.
Somebody's writing that right now. That lawsuit will be filed any day now.
So someone in this state in the coming days, weeks, or got to be within a month, and that's just a hunch, but within a relatively short period of time, is going to seek access to the bathroom of their choosing.
Mm-hmm.
And depending on the judge who gets this writ, who gets this brief, based on what the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals did, a judge is within his or her reasonable prudence to say, yep, you, Dave, you, Susie, you, mm-hmm. whomever, have access to this bathroom. Well, that's obviously one person, right? But then the question becomes, well, how many of these briefs are going to be filed? Would a judge, and this would be a pretty aggressive or progressive decision for a judge, but would a judge say, grant everyone access to the bathroom that aligns with their gender identity in a specific school district, or everyone that, comes and asks for it? Essentially, what I'm saying is that in the courts in the not-too-distant future, there's going to be a challenge, at least within the bathroom portion of mm-hmm. HB2, and we're going to get a better sense of whether or not, at the very least, some high school students, are able to use the bathroom that aligns with their identity. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah,
I'm trying to spit out.
I think what that means is the General Assembly won't necessarily have to address it. They can say it's going to play out in the courts and we don't have to do anything at this point. But it will live on in the political arena for now and moving forward. We've seen in the last couple of polls now in the governor's race, we've seen Attorney General Roy Cooper running for governor. He's pulled ahead of Pat McCrory. This has been an issue for Pat McCrory. He went on Meet the Press last weekend. He has been in some circles, sort of a national punching bag for this. Does this help him? Does this hurt him moving forward against Roy Cooper, Jorge?
I think that so far it doesn't look too favorably for him against Roy Cooper. It has been a narrative changer, HB2. I think that the governor at this time of the year, going into the short legislative session that's starting next week, I think what he was hoping to be talking about, perhaps, was the bond referendum that he led the effort mm-hmm. in getting passed. I think that was one of the key components of his campaign for re-election this November. But instead, he's having to defend this law. He's become the public face of this law, perhaps unwillingly, because this is something that came from the General Assembly.
Right.
And the people who wrote this bill are not being the public face of that law.
Right. And the question then becomes, Phil Berger, more, do they care who the governor is?
That's a good question.
Do they care if it's a Republican or a Democrat, as long as they have a veto-proof majority?
Which they do.
And
they will.
It's hard to imagine them not having.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, Jeff, Jess, I mean, chime in here. Do they care? Do they care at all who the governor is? And because it's really the statewide race is where this is going to play out. It's not going
right.
to play out in these you know, small races.
These gerrymandered
races.
Districts. Let's
That's
call
right.
them what
they're,
they are.
They're not going to play out there. They're going to play out for the Senate race and the governor's race. And the interesting question will be, you know, to me is, do they care who the governor is?
Well, listen, I mean, you know, I haven't asked that directly from the leadership in either chamber.
And they're not going to tell you.
And I'm not sure if they would tell me.
Right.
But it's no secret that there is a certain level of animosity between the governor's office and the Senate leader's office.
Right.
There has historically been a lot of tension between those two offices, and there certainly still is.
Yeah.
Right. And to your question, your couple questions ago, Governor McCrory was elected 4 years ago to some extent on the backs of moderates and independents, and his record as you know, someone who towed that middle line as a governor or mayor of Charlotte for 14 years. So this is an issue that certainly plays well to the base. But maybe there's some question about whether or not the base was going to come out in strong numbers. But Governor McCrory, based on conversations I've had with political scientists, needs to carry some of that moderate, some of that independent, purple-streaking vote if he's going to defeat Roy Cooper and get a second term.
Right,
and
those suburbs of Charlotte, suburbs of Raleigh voters
right.
who can go
mm-hmm.
either way depending yeah. on sort of
right.
a policy and who they like.
Right. As for the conversation about whether or not General Assembly leadership wants him in that seat, one side of the coin is, of course, they want him there. He's
right.
a Republican, and he's an ally on some issues, if not all. But if this is an issue that, you know, scores them more political points, plays well with the conservative base, and they lose the governor, they lose the governor. That's the other side of the coin, right? This isn't their good buddy. This isn't somebody that they served in the General Assembly with, who, you know, they've collaborated with or have worked closely with on a lot of issues. And then, I mean, to make an analogy, and hopefully it's not too dangerous or too far-reaching of one, it would be interesting, this is not me passing judgment, it would be interesting if Roy Cooper carries the gubernatorial race. Josh Stein is a key part of that. I mean, they don't run together as they do in some states, the governor mm-hmm. and attorney general. But if you think of it as Cooper and Stein in, you know, on one track, on one avenue, and then you've got the supermajorities on the other side, it almost in some ways resembles what's happening at the federal level with President Obama and Republican majorities in both chambers and a grinding of, you know, much happening, and also just a constant battle, a constant
right.
fight back and forth. And we've seen some fights between McCrory and Berger and Moore. Can you imagine, Jorge, what those are going to look like if it's, you know, if it's Berger on one side and Cooper and or Stein on the other? I mean, to me, the rhetoric, the divisiveness is only going to get cranked way up.
If we have a Democratic governor, probably.
Right,
yeah.
Because you think
yeah.
of all the boards that they both appoint to. You think
yeah.
of the Department of Environmental Quality, DHHS,
and
all
there have
the
been
different
lawsuits.
Right.
The governor, along with the help of previous governors, have filed lawsuits against the General Assembly, saying that they're overreaching, they're overstepping their authority
right.
into his area.
Right. That's all in the future, and we'll have plenty of time to talk more about that. But let's sort of end this up by looking at this short session that starts Monday. Other than HB2, which may or may not be addressed, what can we expect the first week? Jorge, let's start with you.
Very quickly, the objective of the short session is to shore up, to polish up the biannual state budget. That officially is the objective every single year when you have all 170 members in the building. A lot of other things can happen, and very often we don't have any advance notice of that until maybe the day before. But during this first week, there have already been some appropriations committee meetings scheduled. We are also expecting that sometime very soon that the governor is going to put out his version of the budget, which is the very first step in the process. He's already made some comments on it, in particular to education, which is something that Jess has reported on. So at least during this first week, hopefully what we'll see is some beginning of conversations on that on the side of the House of Representatives, which will be the first chamber that will take up the budget once the governor comes out with his version.
Jess, what are some of the big education issues? We talked about the budget, teacher salaries, other things. What's coming up?
Sure, yeah. In the budget, so we already know McCrory's budget will include a 5% average raise for teachers and also a 3% average bonus for teachers. And that's supposed to be weighted to help out more veteran teachers. And then kind of getting away from the budget policy-wise, a bill sponsored by Republican Representative Rob Bryan of Mecklenburg County seeks to create an achievement school district. And basically what that does, it's based off of a model that Tennessee is using, where they take some of the lowest performing schools and put them in a newly created district that's run by its own superintendent, and they're all run like charter schools. And some of those can be run by the superintendent like charter schools, and some of them are run by charter management organizations. So this is a really controversial bill. It has support from Republicans and a few Democrats, but it is controversial mostly because it has research from Vanderbilt shows that after 3 years in Tennessee, it's had minimal impact on student performance there. So that's going into committee. Whether it makes it to the floor, you know, we're not sure. And then also in education, legislators have been talking about differentiated teacher pay. And so basically that means that, you know, some teachers are, you know, right now we have a flat pretty much like a flat rate for teachers, and it's only based on experience. Teachers gain more money based on how long they've been in the profession. And this bill would seek to change that, so it would be based more maybe on performance, maybe on professional development, opportunities. There's a range of things they could use, and this would be a pilot program. So that's coming up, and then also some senior Republicans have talked about wanting to increase the salaries for the state's assistant principals. Mm-hmm. They are compared to the nation and the region, they're vastly underpaid compared to neighboring states.
And anybody with kids in schools knows that assistant principals hold a school together, especially when you get up into middle and high school. Assistant principals are really
important. That's the warden right there.
It
right?
is the
That's
warden, the but warden. Also every aspect of just moving children around, and they are very important people, Jeff.
Raises are going to be a big one. And, you know, we heard from June Atkinson a couple of months ago, state superintendent, about she called for a 10% raise, which on its face is not realistic. The governor has offered 5, and we'll hear from Speaker Moore and Senator Berger moving forward. Speaker Moore has said that he is in favor of raises. 5% is a lot, and he would like to see all state employees, not just teachers, get a raise. This obviously is an election year. This is an issue that people like hearing about. Oh, they're going to give me more money. So this is something that politicians will stretch out and they'll kick around and they'll maneuver. It's like Play-Doh, the raise issue, and they'll keep throwing this thing back and forth for a while. I think the other thing that'll be interesting from our perspective, maybe not as much to our listeners, is how long this session runs and if there are surprises, if there are any
big surprises.
Yeah,
this always because our state's one of the states where the General Assembly does not have a set adjournment date.
Right,
so,
right.
I think even before the session starts, it becomes a parlor game for anybody who spends any time in the building to guess, like, oh, right. When do you think that they're going to adjourn
this year?
It's
short session. Short is a relative term.
Right.
Short.
Well, from a historical perspective,
means it's usually less time than one it is
right.
the other year.
It's yeah. worth noting from a historical perspective that they didn't have a short session if you go back 40, 45 years. It was just the every other biannual year. Candidates can't campaign while the short session is still going on.
Right,
so I think of somebody like
factor.
I think of somebody like Buck Newton, who's running for attorney general, who's still in the Senate. That's just one out of 50 senators. But, mm-hmm. you know, there are some, and there are a handful of legislators who are running for congressional seats who would like to, presumably, who would like to be going and raising money and campaigning and trying to, you know, elevate to that next office. And at the same time, we have some legacy lawmakers, Bob Rucho, Tom Apodaca, Skip Stamm in the House, who are sunsetting, if you will. They're
very
heading
influential
away.
Members. Made a lot of big changes.
Do they go out with a bang,
right.
Or do they
interesting dynamic?
Do they just kind of celebrate their past accomplishments? We'll see.
On the topic of when we will adjourn, and I'm going to do my best. I promise this session to not play into this. You know, every other day asking, hey, when do you think we're going to adjourn? but there was an interesting, there is an interesting bill that has been written by a Republican representative from Wilmington. His name is Rick Catlin. He is stepping down this year.
The per diem bill?
The per diem bill.
Yeah.
Which seeks to limit the number of days every year in which state representatives can receive their per diem of about $104, I believe is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't limit the length, the amount of time that the representative, the General Assembly can be there in session, but it will limit the amount of time that they're going to get their hotel paid for.
Right.
So he says that he hopes that that will be an encouragement for them to adjourn within usually by the beginning of July. He says that he has gotten some favorable feedback from his colleagues. And who knows? I mean, this might be something difficult to pass. I mean, I think it's somewhat telling that the person who is going to be presenting this is somebody who's not going to be running for re-election.
Yes. Exactly.
Thursday, July 14th. That's it.
That's the day.
Yep. And when I'm right, you all can buy me a round of beer.
That'd be impressive.
No,
we'll come back.
No, because I'm not playing into this.
That'll be good. No, we'll come back to that. All right. Well, that's it for this edition of the podcast. Thanks for listening to the WUNC Politics Podcast. Make sure to subscribe on our website, WUNC.org, and follow all of the WUNC Politics stories from Jeff DeBerry, Jorge Valencia, and Jess Clark on air and online. See you next week.